Good morning. You can be opening your Bibles to Romans 12. Part of what we just sang is the weak made strong through the Savior's love. I don't know in your life right now if you're feeling like you have spiritual strength to do the things that God has asked you to do. But the place where we find strength is in the nurturing love that God has shown to us. All the things that he sacrificed for us, the way that he left the comforts of where he was and came down here to a place where every sin that was ever committed was ultimately against him because he's God. Imagine being in just a room filled with people that have all hurt you in some way. How would your composure be? Well, here's Jesus come into this world and every evil thought anybody's ever had, every evil deed done in secret, all ultimately done against him. And when he came, the way that he sacrificed, the way that he loved, is something that's supposed to inspire us with strength, and it's supposed to inspire us with hope. Hope is one of the things that in our society, I think right now, is very lacking. There's a lot of evidence in our society that people don't have a lot of hope for the future. Less and less people having children, which in traditionally in societies when less and less people want children, it has something to do with the lack of hope they have for the future of the nation. Other people concerned with environmental concerns, suicide rates going up more and more, especially among teenage girls. There's all kinds of things around us that could fill us with hopelessness. But one of the things that Christianity offers is to meet our deepest needs, one of them being our need for hope. That's found in the loving sacrifice of Christ. That's found in what Jesus has secured for us and accomplished for us in the sacrifice that he made for us. We're going to see some of those ideas in this text this morning as we continue our series on the book of Romans. We've been looking at the book of Romans chapter 12 once a month this year. And everything we're looking at stems from Romans 12, 1 and 2, which says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Even though Paul, as an apostle, has the authority given to him by God to command people, you all better start being living sacrifices. You notice in this text that he's appealing. Please consider this in your life. Please think about the mercies that God has shown to you. Think about his love. Think about how in the first 11 chapters of Romans, which is summarized here as the mercies of God, because he's appealing to them for the rest of the book based on those mercies. Consider that before God, you only deserved his wrath. But through Jesus' sacrifice, there was a propitiation that was made. There was a sacrifice that was made that allows you to be right with God. Please, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. That's the challenge that we've been looking at this year. And I want to remind us some of the things that we've looked at up to this point. In February, we talked about finding and using your gift. We don't find and use our gifts to serve the Lord, to try to save ourselves. We do it out of appreciation of the salvation we've already been given. Same thing with letting our love be genuine or learning to hate what is evil and clinging to what is good. Same thing with brotherly affection. Same thing with not being slothful in zeal but being fervent. The more and more we rest in and meditate on and consider what it is that God has done for us, the kind of person it creates is a Romans 12 kind of person. And today, July, we're looking at Romans chapter 12, verse 12, where we're actually going to see three instructions in the text. Rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. I want us to go ahead and read Romans chapter 12, verses 9 through 13, but we're going to just look at verse 12 in this series of lessons. So look at Romans chapter 12, verses 9 through 13. Let love be genuine, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good, love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honor, do not be slothful in zeal, be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints, and seek to show hospitality. You see there that in verse 12, the one that we're looking at this morning, that you find three instructions, and I want to break down each of one of those in just a moment, but before we do that, I want to point out the middle instruction. The middle instruction says, be patient in tribulation. And this is not the only time in the book of Romans that tribulation is brought up. The fact that the original audience of the book of Romans was going through a lot of difficulties. Romans 8:18 says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us." That verse in a lot of ways summarizes what we're looking at in this lesson. But in Romans chapter 8, there's famine and nakedness and sword and all these things that the original audience of Romans was going through. Notice that in this chapter, Paul is telling these people, I want you to become living sacrifices, but then a few verses later, he says, tribulation is always going to be part of your life. He's not saying, be a living sacrifice, and maybe that will remove the tribulation. Well, it would remove certain kinds of tribulation, I suppose. You're never going to get in trouble with the law for doing something that you should have never done to begin with because you're concerned with doing the things that the Lord has asked you to do. So it takes away some of those kinds of tribulations. But on the other hand, there's going to be people that will mistreat you because of your faith. And just because we live in a world that's broken, there's still going to be difficulties that you're going to face anyways, even when you're still striving to be a living sacrifice. So my desire to be a living sacrifice is not to circumvent or to like do a hack or a cheat code in life that is going to cause me to avoid tribulation. Whenever I think about tribulation in the Bible or suffering in the Bible, I always think about Job. And I think the first or second sermon I ever did here was a sermon on Job. And in that lesson, I talked about four different things that happened to him that all begin with the letter F, or things in his life that were disrupted, or sources of his trials that all begin with the letter F. And I just want to remind us of that because it fits with what we're looking at this morning. Job's finances, when he finds out that all of his animals have died, everything that he has that is of monetary value was just taken away at one moment. Do you think that people today are going through financial tribulations? On Twitter, I see people talking about how 40% of their, what are those things called? Portfolios? I don't have one of those. Whatever those things are, people are losing 40% of them right now. There's my favorite bookstore in the world, ever, is in Bowling Green. The Half Price Books outlet store. It's an outlet, which means it's even more than half off. So you should go there. There's one of the workers there that I've gotten to know, and she was talking about how the cost of gas and the cost of food and the wages not going, it just makes everything more difficult for her. Are you going through any kind of financial tribulation right now? Even as you try to be a living sacrifice, it's still happening. Well, notice another kind of tribulation is in the family. In one moment, all of Job's children died. From, I think it was probably some kind of a tornado or something like that. But do you ever have family issues where there's fighting and bickering, or there's somebody in the family that's passed on and it creates problems in that way? Or what about Job's flesh? When Satan gets permission to put boils all over his body. But in our society right now, 11 to 15%, it's hard to figure out exactly, but 11 to 15% of Americans are on antidepressants. There's mental health problems, there's physical health problems, COVID, cancer, all of these different sorts of things that are very challenging for people. Job's friends, they initially came to try to sympathize and comfort him, but then once they open their mouth, they start to accuse him of doing all kinds of things that he just needs to be more open about and come to terms with, and then all these things can go away. Was the audience of Romans going through any of these sorts of things? You know that if somebody came up to you, if a Roman official came up to you and said, hey, is Caesar Lord? confess that Caesar is Lord and you say no, if you had some kind of business, it would be shut down. What about family issues? We know in this time that there were Jew-Gentile families, or there's Jewish families where some people had become Christians and other people weren't, and it brought all kinds of turmoil in the family. What about flesh? There's audiences. The audience here is in danger of being scourged, and they're in danger of the sword. What about friends? Even in Romans 14, there's conscience issues that the church seems to be having different kinds of problems with. Now, if you're going through anything like this, what's your response to it? The way that we respond to tribulation, which is this whole instruction is given in the context or the backdrop of the reality of tribulation. Whenever you're going through something difficult, it reveals what was always inside of you. And one way that you can remember this is if you take a bug and you squish it, what comes out of it? Bug guts. Got that? Bug guts. If you take somebody and they're like in a pressure cooker of tribulation and they're going through difficulties on all sides, what comes out of you? What kinds of things do you say? What comes out of your character? All of that reveals what was always there, and it enhances what was always there. Here's some bad responses to tribulation. You could become embittered or angry. And maybe one way to think about that would be the woman who dates a couple guys that were all mistreated her, and now she says, all guys are terrible. Or the guy that dates some women, and they let him down, and he goes, all women are terrible. Have you ever known somebody who became so embittered by something difficult that it just made them so jaded about life and about everything? That's not one of the responses that the Christian's supposed to have. Here's another unrighteous response, is that you become impatient. And maybe impatience would mean that there's something good that I want. I want this good thing in my life, and this suffering has caused me to not get it in the timing that I would like to have it. So I will take matters into my own hands and try to grab it for myself. I think about Abraham and Sarai, when God tells Abraham that you're going to have this genealogy that will end up blessing the world. You're going to have this bloodline that's going to be very important. And Abraham and Sarah aren't having any kids, so then let's go ahead and marry Hagar. Taking matters into your own hands. Or when Moses goes up the mountain in Exodus 32, and the Israelites say, well, he's been there long enough, we don't know what's come of him, let's go ahead and make a golden calf. By the way, a nice parallel to that, Jesus has gone up the mountain. He's gone up to the heavenly Jerusalem. Would it be especially tempting for us to become impatient and start to take matters into our own hands and try to fasten things that we can see, that we can worship, we can create some kind of idols in our own life? It doesn't have to be some kind of physical thing. It could be some kind of ideology that you've attached yourself more to because it feels more tangible. What about this one? Seeking relief through sin. This is maybe related to this idea of impatience, but it's different enough to be its own category. That the Bible teaches that sin has momentary pleasure. And so as I'm going through something difficult, as I hear the news reports or as this medical report comes back to me or whatever it could be, maybe if I watch some porn, it'll make me forget about all of it for a moment. Maybe if I go to the bottle and I get drunk, it'll make me forget about all those things. Is that how the Christian should respond, seeking relief through some kind of sin? Or how about giving in to despair? You're just going to give up. I'm done with everything. It goes beyond being embittered. It's just, I'm not going to put any more energy or effort into anything. I'm not even going to be angry about it anymore. I'm just done. Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychoanalyst during World War II, and he was in one of the camps. And as a psychoanalyst, he continued to psychoanalyze people. And he wrote a book called The Search for Meaning. And this is one of the things that he said about people who gave in to despair. The prisoner who had lost faith in the future, his future, was doomed. With his loss of belief in the future, he also lost his spiritual hold. He let himself decline and become subject to mental and physical decay. Usually this happened quite suddenly. So Frankl, I guess, saw people who just gave up. They wouldn't get out of bed. They wouldn't put effort into anything anymore, and they would just end up dying in their bed because they were shot or whatever. Have you given into despair? Where because of the tribulation in your life, you don't want to get out of bed in the morning. You don't want to go look for a job. You don't want to do anything proactive. Those would all be unrighteous responses to tribulation. What we're seeing in Romans chapter 12, verse 12, are three proper responses to tribulation and suffering. Now, I want to show you another quote, though, from Viktor Frankl before we look at those three instructions. Viktor Frankl also said this as he was analyzing people. Even though conditions such as lack of sleep, insufficient food, and various mental stresses may suggest that the inmates were bound to react in certain ways, in the final analysis, it becomes clear that the sort of person the prisoner became was the result of an inner decision and not the result of camp influences alone. Fundamentally, therefore, any man can, even under such circumstances, decide what shall become of him, mentally and spiritually. When Frankl was observing people, he saw some people give in to despair, he saw other people react in other ways, but then he saw some people that had a certain kind of staying power, this ability to not give in to despair, this ability to not become so embittered, but there were certain people that still had this hopefulness about them. And it was because they had some kind of view of the afterlife. Now, I'm not saying that their view of the afterlife was correct, but the idea of what hope does for people. Look at the proper responses to suffering, which is, like Frankl says here, is your choice. You have the choice to do these things that Romans 12:12 says. And it doesn't matter how bad your circumstances are. You have the choice to do what this verse is telling you to do. Rejoice. Really? Paul says in Philippians to rejoice in the Lord always. There's apparently always a reason to rejoice. But that seems so elusive. Does that seem elusive in your life? I think about what Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6. In this you rejoice. And in verses 3 through 5, he was just talking about the salvation that they have. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. Do you notice the highlighted part? Though now. What's the thing that you're presently experiencing? Though now you're experiencing various trials, and what that's doing to you is causing you to grieve. Do you know, this is an amazing verse. It says that right now you're suffering and you're grieving, but at the same time you're rejoicing. Do you see that both of these things exist at the same time for the Christian? I'm grieving, but I'm rejoicing. How does that happen? I remember when I was as a new Christian, and every dinner with my family felt like World War III, especially the day that I told them that I was thinking about possibly becoming a preacher. Every dinner, and then I'd go to bed, and it was just fighting after fighting after fighting. And I went to school the next morning. And as soon as I got out of my car, there was one of the girls that I was friends with at school, and we were walking into the college campus. And she asked, how are you doing right now? And my response was, honestly, I'm not doing so good. She was really, religiously minded kind of person. And I said, I'm not doing very well right now. And she, frowned at me, and she said, don't you know that every day in the Lord is a good day? Do you think sometimes we as Christians can have that kind of misconception? That we're supposed to rejoice in the Lord, so we're always smiling and everything's always really great and my house is burning down right now, but I'm happy. Do you see what this verse says? You're grieving. You can see the tears. You can see it on your face. It hurts, but it does not mean you don't have joy. They can exist at the same time. Well, how? Do you notice that in Romans chapter 12, verse 12, it says to rejoice in hope? I'm going to come back and say more about that in just a moment. Rejoice in hope. Which means that you're rejoicing in some future fulfillment of something. Whenever when the Amazon person drives up to your driveway and you're like, yes, it's here. You rejoice in the fulfillment of something. We don't typically rejoice in the thought that it's going to happen. We rejoice when it finally happens. And before it happens, we're really anxious and wanting it to come now. This says we rejoice in our hope. We rejoice now about something that is guaranteed that we don't yet have full acquisition of. So we have to learn to rejoice about something in the future rather than let the present sufferings overshadow the future promises. I'm going to come back to that in just a second. But notice another proper response to suffering is patience. Speaking of Amazon, speaking of microwaves, clear connection, fast food, everything around us, our technology trains us to become impatient. We're used to having everything given to us immediately. And if it can't be one-day shipping, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. The things that people, before technology got to the point that it was, and I'm thankful for a lot of these things, by the way, but before technology became what it is right now, we used to have to do more work to get things, basic things. And we're all growing up in this kind of society. Does that train us to expect things now? And then here the Bible says, be patient. Rejoice in your hope. Be patient. Well, how would I know if I'm patient? The word for patient means to bear under something. It means to bear up under the weight of something in the face of delayed gratification, that I have a steadiness about me, that I'm not going to freak out that I haven't gotten something the timing that I would like to have it. It means that I have guts and fortitude, that even though I'm not getting what I want right now, I'm not going to give in to sin. I'm not going to become embittered. All those false responses that we talked about. And then there's the final instruction in Romans 12:12, which is prayer. Praying constantly. One of the things that you see in the book of Job, thinking about him again, is that Job throughout the whole book kept the conversation with God going. There's times where his friends will say something to him, and he'll respond to them, and then he'll have like a soliloquy where he starts speaking to God and almost like turning his face away from the friends is kind of the picture that you get. He does that throughout the whole book. James chapter 5, verse 13. Is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing praises. You notice, by the way, whether you're suffering or cheerful, the proper response is always to go to God. Sometimes it's with songs, sometimes it's with prayer, but there's no time going to God is inappropriate. You know what? One of the ways that I'm going to properly respond to tribulation is that I never get so embittered with my circumstances that praying to God would have no use anyways. What's your prayer life been like recently? One of the themes that happens in the book of Acts is throughout the whole book, they're praying together constantly. And it's not just to close a worship service or introduce a worship service. They'll spontaneously do it as the need arises. Whenever there's some kind of thing that they need to talk about and pray about, they do those things together. All right. If those are the proper ways to respond to tribulation, ask yourself if that's on your radar. If you have tribulation and you're crying and it's on your face, that's fine. But do you still have joy deep within your heart? Are you patient, or are you giving in to sin or trying to find momentary relief through sin? Are you continuing to talk to God? Well, those seem like really difficult, like a tall order. What gives us the power to do this? And I want to come back to this idea at the beginning of verse 12 where he says to rejoice in hope. If I don't have hope, I won't do any of those things. But if I learn what hope can do in my life, I will have all of those things. Well, what is it that hope does? I want to give you a couple ways to think about this. A couple years ago, Samantha and I we went through all the Harry Potter movies, like instant classic kind of things. And when we watched all those movies, Samantha had pointed out to me that there was the girl that played the role of Luna Lovegood. I don't know if you know her story. Her name is Ivana Lynch, the actor. And it's really interesting what happened with her. She used to write letters to J.K. Rowling, the writer of the Harry Potter books. And she looked to her for like counsel. And she used to struggle with anorexia. And she told J.K. Rowling that I really like the Luna Lovegood character. I really resonate with her. She's given me hope. And J.K. Rowling had sent her back a letter saying, if you can overcome this problem of anorexia, I'll let you play the role of Luna Lovegood in the movies. And Ivana Lynch said this about it. This is what J.K. Rowling told her. She told me anorexia is destructive, not creative, and the brave thing was not to succumb to it. I told her I'd love to be in the films, and she encouraged that, but said I'd need to be well to do so. In the end, I think that's why I recovered. What did hope do for somebody like this? I could play in these movies the role that I've resonated with in the books that I've read, and I have a chance of playing in that? And that hope drove her to overcome this thing that was debilitating for her. What can hope do for people? Think about another example with the Apostle Paul. Paul hoped to reach Rome. He says this in Romans 15, 24. I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain and to be helped on my journey there by you once I have enjoyed your company for a while. Paul really wants to see the Roman Christians. He had never met them before. He knew a lot of them, though, but he had never been there before. And so he wants to go there. He says the same thing in Acts 18 or 19. I think it's chapter 19. Did he ever get a promise that he was going to go there? In Acts chapter 23, verse 11, Jesus comes to Peter and he says, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. All right, here's a promise from Jesus. If the last few chapters of Acts have always been like, well, it's just kind of like Paul is before this governor, he's before that governor, there's a shipwreck, all that kind of stuff, and it's kind of like jumbled up, but it's not as exciting as like the first part of the book. Here's a really interesting way to look at the rest of the book of Acts from chapter 23 on. Paul's promised by Jesus, you are going to make it to Rome. Paul has his hope that he's going to get there. Have you thought about all the tribulation Paul experiences after this promise is given in Acts 23? The next thing that happens is 40 Jewish men decide that they're going to fast until they murder Paul. I wonder which one of them was the first one to break that fast. But the next thing that happens is people are plotting to murder him. He's already incarcerated. And then when he has to get moved to Caesarea, he's 2 years under Felix, who's wanting bribes from Paul that he never gives to him. 2 years under an unrighteous ruler. And eventually he gets out and then he gets onto the ship that's heading for Rome, but it crashes on the island of Malta where he gets bit by a snake. That's just a quick snapshot. But during all of that time, do you see Paul giving into despair? Do you see him justifying sin for momentary pleasure? Do you see him becoming embittered? Do you see any of those kinds of reactions? What would have given him hope through all of that? Jesus said, I was going to make it. And if Jesus said that, I can be in prison for 2 years. I can survive a snake bite. I can survive a plot for people to murder me. I can survive a shipwreck. I can do these things because Jesus said I was going to get there. Have you noticed the strength of Paul from Acts 23 on, anchored in those promises? And you think about our life. We're promised something better than acting in a movie. We're promised something better than getting to some big city someday. What is it that we're promised? 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 and 17. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we will always be with the Lord. In Buddhism or pantheistic religions, when you die, you're like a dewdrop going back to the ocean. Like you no longer have your individuality. You get absorbed into something bigger than yourself. This text says, we who are alive will be caught up with them. The Christian hope is that you always get to be you. You never stop being you. But you're going to be you with a perfected body. Do you see that in verse 16? That the dead will rise. When Jesus would had Lazarus rise, it was literally out of a grave. The picture for the Christian, if Jesus is going to defeat death, what must happen to every person? We must all literally be raised out of our graves. And then he's going to separate the sheep from the goats, and he's going to transform your body to be a perfect body. You always get to be you, but you get to be you in a perfected body. The way that it's described in 1 Corinthians 15, it's imperishable, it's glorious, it's powerful, it's animated by the Spirit. You won't need any more surgeries. You won't have any more pain. Perfect body given to you. George Herbert was a famous poet in the 1500s. And he said that death used to be an executioner, but the gospel made him a gardener. You see, you drive by some of these cemeteries in Bowling Green, what's going to happen on Judgment Day? Everybody's coming out of the graves. And if you've been eaten by a shark or cremated, God made Adam from the dust and he can recreate you from the dust, and he'll raise everybody up and then judge and then give you a perfect restored body, animated by the Spirit. You notice in verse 17 that you get to be with them. You get to be with other Christians that have passed on. By the way, Paul's writing this in 1 Thessalonians because there were some of these people who had passed on. And he says to these people, those people that meant a lot to you that have died, you get to be with them perfected forever as well, but all of you get to be with the Lord, who in the Bible is described as the God of all comfort, the light of the world, the good shepherd, the refuge for the oppressed, the perfect father. He's the God of all grace. He's the redeemer. He's all these things. All the light in the world emanates from the Son. All the love you've ever experienced emanates from Jesus. And you, when we get to be with him forever, we don't just have consciousness. People in hell will have consciousness. You get to be loved eternally, forever. Rejoice in your hope. The sufferings that I'm going through now have no comparison to the glory that's going to be revealed later. Rejoice in your hope. Don't let your current tribulations overshadow these great things that we don't even know how to fully comprehend or describe or express. If you were promised that at the top of a mountain there was a box there with $10 million waiting for you, but you had to go hike up that mountain, do you suppose there might be times that you'd stumble and maybe like scuff up your knee and it would hurt? Maybe you'd cry a little bit and maybe it's difficult. And in all of that, could you still have joy? Rejoice in the hope that when I get to the top of the mountain, I'm going to be rewarded in some way. This life's filled with difficulties that make us cry and weep. But the thing that gives us the fuel to get through it is the hope that we have that we don't have the full culmination of right now. Rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. Is anybody here that's subject to the invitation? We're about to sing the song, Blessed Assurance. God has assured us many things. Jesus is going to be our husband when he returns. He's going to come back for his bride that's currently going through difficulties, but he's going to rescue us one day. If there's anybody that has any needs, this is an opportunity to reorient your life back to God while we stand, while we sing.